From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, seeking some form of gun control in Michigan.
This is not about hunting. This is not about the Second Amendment. This is about keeping people from doing things that are really dangerous.
A fresh focus on victims' rights.
Michigan in 1985 was one of the first states to pass a constitutional amendment that provides victims' rights. But for whatever reason, none of those rights have had any teeth in them. There's been no mechanism to enforce them.
The growing need for midwives.
There are many counties in Michigan that don't have any obstetric services, so no obstetrician clinics, no hospitals that deliver babies.
And the Mosaic Youth Theater throws a 60th birthday bash for Motown Records.
This tells a Motown story that has never really been told before.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later on today's program, midwives are now required to be licensed to practice in Michigan. We'll talk to an advocate about how midwifery can help in underserved communities. But first, we want to briefly address an exchange we had yesterday on this program with Republican State Representative Hank Vopel. During the interview, we asked him to name instances where mass shootings were committed by folks on the political left. After the show, some listeners reminded us about the shooter at the 2017 Republican congressional softball practice that left four wounded, including Congressman Steve Scalise. And yesterday, evidence emerged that the Dayton shooter cited radical left-wing viewpoints. What we know is that the tie that binds all of these shooters is not political leanings, but the fact that they are murderers. So what are our elected representatives doing to try to prevent these murders from happening in the future? That was the focus of our conversation with the representative yesterday, and that's the focus of our conversation today. Joining us now is Democratic State Senator Rosemary Bayer, who introduced gun control legislation in Lansing. Senator, would you tell us what your proposals would do?
Yeah, sure. This is our first step. So we do see multiple steps in a process of fixing this, of course. The first set of legislation that we introduced jointly is referred to as red flag legislation. And the idea is that this would allow family members who notice that something might be going awry with someone to be able to report them to the police, who can confiscate people's guns temporarily. So it gives people protection just in the short term. It's up to a year, but within 14 days they would have a hearing to determine if there really is reason for them to have their guns confiscated, and they'll get them back. It's a temporary thing, but the idea is to avoid things that sort of happen in the moment that are driven by some kind of crisis. So we worked with law enforcement to build into these pieces of legislation some penalties for false reporting, so that we don't have people who are just mad at somebody in their family go and call the police on them.
And what evidence do you have that a red flag law like this, like these measures, that are more restrictive on guns will make us safer?
Well, so, you know, a lot of the research that's been going on really for the last 50 years, but in particular since 2006, point to the fact that most of the time, these kind of shootings, the shooter has shown evidence of some kind of crisis point in the previous weeks. And often there are people that notice this one way or another. There's really no avenue for them to take. If they do see that situation, there's no place for them to go. And there's actually specific circumstances where family members have said, we could see it and we had no place to go. So here's a place to go. Here's an action you can take. And it's not going to change every direction in that person's life permanently. It's a way to stop something happening in the immediate term while the situation is addressed, right?
But how do we keep from stigmatizing people who are dealing with mental illness when enacting these red flag laws, particularly considering mental health experts tell us that people with mental illness are more likely to be victims of crime rather than the perpetrators?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges that we're facing in trying to enact this kind of legislation, is there's this tendency right now to blame the mentally ill for what's going on. And so fixing the mental health system. And then there have been efforts to put laws in place in Michigan and in other places to help people when someone is mentally ill from doing this kind of thing. But that's not the kind of situation that we're seeing. Those are not the people that are actually doing these shootings. They're people that are not in that circumstance. So changing those laws, not that we don't need to, we do need to continue to do better in helping our people with mental illness. But for this situation, this is not about that. This is about just people on the street, people that you would never, you know, normally you wouldn't know. You might notice, if you're a family member, that things are going awry. So to blame the mentally ill for this is just a distraction. It's not going to help us solve the problem at all.
And what do you say to those who feel that measures like this infringe on their Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a pretty big supporter of the Constitution, so there's that. But I also come from a hunting family, and this is not about hunting. This is not about the Second Amendment. This is about keeping people from doing things that are really dangerous for public safety, for the health of our families, for the health of our kids. We have to protect our children. This is not about needing to change the Constitution or not respecting the Constitution in any way at all.
People in Dayton shouted down their governor, Mike DeWine, this week as he tried to speak. They shouted, do something. And on Tuesday, he proposed a number of proposals, including a red flag law, also background checks for most firearm purchases and more access to mental health treatment. And then we saw Ohio's Republican Senator Rob Portman stepping forward saying he supports red flag laws. Why do you think these two GOP leaders moved toward these gun control measures?
Well, I hope it's because, you know, nearly 90% of the American population want these gun control measures, right? You would hope that they're listening to the people. And this stuff is just getting so awful that we have to take action. There is also, finally taking action stage, our president who spoke up and said, you know, I think we should have red flag laws. States should look at red flag laws. So even in those reaches, we're starting to see support for taking action and doing something legislatively.
On Tuesday, we spoke with State Rep. Hank Vopel, who's chair of the House Health Policy Committee, and he very much preferred to focus on beefing up mental health measures and funding. What are you hearing from your Republican colleagues? Are you getting a sense that any of the Republican majority in Michigan's legislature might be reaching that tipping point to consider more restrictions on guns?
I hope so. I mean, I have been trading calls with the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Shirky, and, to encourage him to get that hearing scheduled for us in the Senate. It's his committee. And, they, too, recognize there's a problem. These are good people underneath it all. It's just understanding what the underlying issue is and looking at the data and appreciating this is not about mental health. We do want to fix that problem also. However, this is different. And we have legislation in front of you. We also have other legislation that's coming soon, going to be introduced soon for safe storage laws as well as background checks. So all these different pieces put together start to build something that's really going to make a difference for us.
After yesterday's conversation with Representative Vopel, reports emerged that the shooter in Dayton voiced support on social media for what some would call radical left views, while the shooter in El Paso voice support from what some would call radical right views. This issue has become highly politicized. How do we take the politics out of what is a senseless and heinous act and get down to true bipartisan policy changes?
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is we need to just stop talking about that. We need to just talk about what it takes to address the issue. Yes, we have a problem with racial violence and with those extreme viewpoints, but the more airtime we give them, the more they're copying each other. That's one of the things that the data show that causes more of these shootings is that exposure, and people want to copycat those crimes. And our focus needs to be on legislation like universal background checks and red flag laws that will actually specifically address the issue. But these gun control or these minor, they're really actually pretty simple pieces of legislation that are supported by the vast majority of Americans, including gun owners, are going to address the issue today.
Senator, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Democratic State Senator Rosemary Bayer. We turn now to find out what law enforcement officials have in mind to place to monitor individuals who just might be at risk for committing acts of violence. Robert Stevenson is Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. Bob, for most of us, it is normal to feel like a mass shooting just couldn't happen in our community. How do law enforcement officials think of it?
No, actually, one of the things we all think about and we train about is it can happen here. We hope it will never happen here, but one of the things which our agencies are very reticent of the fact is it can happen here. And we do train for that, and we think about it often.
And what do you see as the biggest challenges for police in preventing someone from going on some kind of a shooting spree?
Well, it is extremely preventable. And although there is a common theme that runs through many of these incidents that take place, is that the person suffered from some type of a mental disability and people knew about it, but they never came forward and said anything about it. So there wasn't an opportunity for the police to look into it and maybe have an opportunity to prevent that.
And you say extremely preventable.
Well, I don't know whether it's extremely preventable, but at least if we're forewarned, we have an opportunity. One of the things that came out of 9/11 is that a lot of the pieces of that terrorist activity were known. A lot of clues were known to various law enforcement agencies, but nobody was able to connect the dots. So coming out of 9/11 was developed what they call the Fusion Center, which is an opportunity for police agencies and such to share intelligence information. And here in Michigan, that's all handled through what's called the MIOC, which is the Michigan Intelligence Operations Center, which is operated by the Michigan State Police. And there are members from the Department of Homeland Security, Michigan State Police, some members from our association or the Sheriff's Association. And it's a place where when tips come in about people that are suspicious or about supremacist groups, that they can all be gathered and then disseminated out to a local police department or another federal agency for investigation.
What is the constitutional line between someone exercising free speech and being a party to hate crime? How do you address that line in policing?
Well, that's the difficult question, and the courts struggle with that also. We recognize that we all have free speech in this country, yet you can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire. So somewhere between free speech and somewhere between that type of activity is the line that has to be defined, and that's difficult. And courts have difficulty with it, prosecutors have difficulty with it, and police agencies have difficulty with it.
Robert Stevenson, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank you for being with us, Bob.
Thank you very much.
More Stateside yet to come. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
If we have to go to the White House, I'm going as myself.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
What it means is open up your goddamn market the way we opened up ours.
Civil War history continues to fascinate us almost 160 years later. And while Michigan played a major role in deciding the outcome of this war, you typically have to travel outside of Michigan to really connect with a tangible aspect of Civil War history. But did you know that Julia and General Ulysses S. Grant lived in Detroit before the war, and the house they called home is still within the city limits? So let's learn more about this Civil War connection as we say hello to the director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Good to have you on Stateside, Sandra.
Thank you.
And we want to welcome Grant House enthusiast Laura Raich. Laura, good to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So tell me, first of all, Laura, where was the Grant House originally located?
It was originally located on Fort Street between Rivard and Russell in Detroit, and that area doesn't exist anymore, actually. It's now what most people know as Lafayette Park.
Ah, very good. All right, got that. Just east of I-75.
Correct.
And when and why were the Grants in Detroit?
The Grants were in Detroit. They were newlyweds in Detroit He was serving as quartermaster at the Detroit Barracks.
Sandra, tell us when and why were the Grants in Detroit, and what do we know about their life while they were here?
They're living in Detroit between 1849 and 1851, and they are newlyweds. They don't have a whole lot of money. We know not a whole lot about them, though we do know that Grant had a horse that was a very fine horse that he loved to race up and down Fort Street.
I'm kind of, this is really giving us a different look at that sober-faced man that we know from Civil War photos when he was the general. Julia, I think that we know that Julia and the general lived in a number of places, but what makes Detroit's Grant home so special, Laura?
What makes it, there's several reasons why it's so special. One, it's one of the oldest homes still standing. It was built in 1837. And when General Grant and his wife left Detroit, their memory didn't quite leave. The home was saved and moved. General Grant was mourned when he passed. Detroit came together. They were actually one of the first cities to send their condolences upon Grant's passing. It was saved in 1936. So roughly 100 years later, from when it was built, it was moved to the state fairgrounds. And then again, it was moved in 1957 to a different location within the state fairgrounds. So people have been enamored with this home because of its occupants.
And I remember clearly seeing that White House at the fairgrounds every year when we would go to the state fair. So, Sandra, when it was at the state fairgrounds there on Woodward, just south of 8 Mile, what was the role of the house? Was it an exhibit?
It was open usually during the state fair. The Detroit Historical Society did some exhibitry there. They did some interpretation there. Not very much that was original to the Grants survived. Detroit Historical has a little bit, but it was never open, I don't think, on a real regular basis.
And was it pretty much the original house, or had there been additions made to it?
It's pretty close to the original. Looking at the early maps, it's pretty clear, and actually architects have confirmed this, that the back half of the second story was added later.
Okay.
And when you hear the Grants' descriptions, that makes sense too. But the first floor is basically what it was.
Laura, I know we all remember when the fair shut down in 2008. I remember reading in the Detroit News that this poor house didn't fare very well after that. I saw, you know, mentions of a dirty waterbend on the second floor.
And I cringe every time I hear that, because people are so quick to go toward the dark, the negative. But it was boarded up.
Yeah.
It was used in several ways. I mean, it was not well cared for in regard to the things they stored inside of it. But, I mean, I think it's amazing to me that the structure is still there. People haven't tagged it. It's been protected, even though it had these things in it. And it you know, as it was updated, the bathrooms and the staircase railing that might have a crack in it or two, the waterbed. But the home, you walk into the home, and it's all still there. You can still feel it.
You can feel it. And now it's moving to the Eastern Market. Sandra, when did this effort to move the house begin, and why?
Well, it actually began when the state fairgrounds closed. Was the first time we started talking about it. And it's because it's obviously going into private ownership. And some people stepped forward and said, that's all well and good, but the Michigan History Center should figure out a new home for it and make sure it's preserved. And it's taken us quite a while to reach an agreement. We really wanted to keep it in Detroit because it belongs to Detroit, but we also needed to have someone who would give us an easement and the insurance that we wouldn't have to move it again.
So there have been some issues trying to find a new home for the Grant House. Is Eastern Market a good home, Laura?
It's a fantastic home, and I that couldn't be a more honest answer. It is much closer to its original location. Eastern Market Partnership is so excited to have this home. And the really one of the neatest things about it is that its location for its purpose, it will be seen by thousands of people. Their garden development, the one thing that Julia and Ulysses noted in their letters to one another and their letters to friends was the fruit and vegetables, the ability to walk outside of their porch and have grapes and pears and peaches. And where this home is going, right at the Dequindre Cut opening, right next door to it, is the open markets. So it's a perfect fit.
Thank you so much, Laura. Laura Raich, who is a Grant House enthusiast par excellence, and Sandra Clark from the Michigan History Center. Always great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Michigan was one of the first states to enshrine victims' rights into its state constitution. But more than 30 years on, there is no real mechanism set up to enforce those rights. Well, that is about to change thanks to a grant from, in part, the DOJ. Sarah Prout Rennie is executive director of the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
So yours is one of six groups chosen to receive a grant for the RISE Project, Victims Rights Enforcement Project. What's this project about?
So this project, and we are deeply honored to have received this money nationally, is to provide attorneys for victims in the criminal legal system. This has been a dream of mine for over 20 years, and we're very excited the federal government is working to fund making sure victim advocacy is present in our criminal justice system.
So tell us, on the ground, what's it going to mean, this grant? What will you be able to do with this grant from the National Crime Victim Law Institute and the U.S. Department of Justice?
Well, it is a clinical, so we'll be hiring two attorneys and then working with two law schools, Michigan State and Wayne State University. We'll have an office in Okemos and one in Detroit, and we'll be teaching students as well as taking cases for crime victims. A good example of one of those cases that we wish we had had this project for would be a child pornography case where dad had sexually assaulted the child, taken videos, and in the criminal case, the defense attorney, in violation of a variety of different statutes and ethical norms, took stills back to the perpetrator. While the prosecutor was offended by this, it's not really his role to assert the victim's rights, but it was devastating for the victim that her perpetrator got to see once again this sexually abusive material. So it was one of the cases that prompted us to write for this grant.
And so having that clinic, how could having that clinic and these attorneys that you're going to hire and also the students you're going to train, how would that have changed that situation?
Well, the idea is that if the victim had her own attorney, someone would be there to represent her interests. They would have filed a motion to make sure that the statutory requirements that file be sealed were taken care of. They would have made sure that the defense attorney was held accountable, sanctioned, and ultimately that there were additional consequences to the perpetrator for seeking to review this material that was deeply designed to damage that particular action. We believe was designed to damage the victim so she would come to a plea bargain. So while the prosecutor's job is not to represent the victim, it's to represent the state and get a conviction, these attorneys' jobs are to make sure that the criminal justice system doesn't further re-victimize simply by its own nature.
Let's drill down on that and talk about victims' rights in
sure.
Michigan. Sarah Prout Rennie, what problems do you believe victims currently face in Michigan's legal system?
Well, there's significant numbers. Michigan in 1985 was one of the first states to pass a constitutional amendment that provides victims' rights. And we were very much ahead. But for whatever reason, none of those rights have had any teeth in them. There's been no mechanism to enforce them. So sexual assault victims, domestic violence victims, trafficking victims are often not consulted, are often not aware of what's happening. They're often, for example, we have a rape shield law. Often they're asked, despite that rape shield law, extensive questions about their sexual history. This is particularly important because for sexual assault, for example, less than 3% of sexual assaults actually even get to the courtroom. And one of the reasons is victims don't want to come forward, and they don't want to come forward because this is an extremely brutal process.
The Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence was one of only six groups, as we were saying, nationwide chosen for this grant. Why is Michigan a good fit for this grant?
Well, we were very lucky in that we have the support of the Prosecuting Association of Michigan, and we are working with prosecutors, not in opposition to them, that prosecutors want this sort of advocacy in the courtroom. We also have a remarkably good constitutional amendment. It just hasn't been, the supporting victims' rights, it just has not been enforced.
And as you were saying, this goes back all the way to the mid-'80s. So Michigan kind of was on the forefront of the victims' rights movement.
Absolutely. And then for whatever reason, we've fallen very far behind. And one of the things I do want to make sure that we also will be doing as an advocacy group is making sure victims are not lost in the governor's new push to change sort of the criminal justice system. We definitely want changes in the criminal justice system, but we don't want those voices forgotten. And Michigan is sort of, with the new governor's task force, also at the forefront of looking at what we're doing. So this was a unique opportunity as well for us to have and strengthen the voices of victims in opposition to the, not opposition, in collaboration with the voices of changes in the incarceration system.
Speaking of being lost, in recent years, Michigan got a lot of negative attention for all of those untested rape kits that were just sitting on shelves in Wayne County for years. Could this clinic help change the narrative for crime victims in this state to make sure that something like that does not happen again?
That is absolutely our goal. We are passionate about that. I have had colleagues that have worked on the testing of those kits. I have every respect for the work that's been done to remedy that situation. And we absolutely do not want that ever to happen again. Overall, we also see this as an important conversation about the ways in which women and minorities who are victims are often unheard. And Michigan is a uniquely situated state to be able to raise up the voices of those victims. Our particular project will have two focuses. One will be in northern Michigan. We have a large indigenous population in Michigan that often gets missed. And there is a plethora of folks who are raped and murdered on tribal lands where they're not seeing any sort of justice throughout the nation. Mm-hmm. And you may be aware of that through some of the social media campaigns. We really want to make change in our northern communities. And the reason we've chose Detroit is particularly around underserved, is around those rape kits, around domestic violence, around underserved populations that have not been able to have a voice in justice.
Another thing I'd love to get your thoughts on. Here we are sitting in 2019, and part of our lives is it's the rise of technology. So with messaging apps and photos that can be texted instantly, there are new tools of domestic abuse. How does technology affect the experience of victims going through the legal process?
That is an excellent question. One of the challenges of the law is that it's slow. And there's a lot of things within our legal system that just hasn't adapted to the rise in technology. So perpetrators are using technology to further abuse and harass their victims through criminal cases to dissuade them from coming forward. And often those social media and technological advances are not being caught by restraining orders or other types of bond conditions because it's simply not thought of. You know, we certainly haven't had enough training on the complexities of the new technology. We just haven't caught up. And that is an area of great interest to the coalition.
Some legal scholars and attorneys, Sarah, worry that too heavy a focus on victims' rights in the courtroom could place too much focus on vengeance and threaten the defendants' rights. And we've seen crime victim stories used by politicians to advocate for harsher punishments, punishments that have often disproportionately fallen on people of color or people on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder. What role do you see the clinic playing in this conversation about balancing victims' rights with ensuring fairness in our criminal justice system?
That is another excellent question. We believe very strongly in due process. We believe very strongly in the rule of law. And we believe there's a balance for both, because just as the criminal justice system disproportionately has affected perpetrators of color, victims of color, and economically disadvantaged victims are not seeing justice either. It is a important two-way conversation that we look at race, socioeconomic status, and gender in our systems and tailor appropriate responses that are measured and balance the rights and needs of both. But we cannot lose the fact that, again, 3% of sexual assault victims make it even to court, and less than 0.5% ever get a conviction. Mm-hmm. Similarly, domestic violence is a misdemeanor. Trafficking is barely on the radar, and we have half of our Native population that will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime.
There's a lot of work to do.
There is a lot of work to do.
And you're hiring two attorneys with this grant, opening these clinics in Detroit and in Okemos. But what are your hopes? Where do you want to see this go?
I would like this to be part of, that statewide dialogue. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to first enforce our crime victims' rights. We have laws on the books, and we believe in that just as due process is important, there was a reason we passed the Crime Victims' Rights Act, and we want that balance. In addition, we want to be part of this larger conversation of absolutely there's an over-incarceration of certain nonviolent crimes, but let's not lose the fact that victims of violent crimes deserve accountability and safety.
Sarah Prout-Rennie, Executive Director of the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence. Sarah, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Last week, new regulations went into effect that changed the practice of midwifery in Michigan. After years of debate and advocacy, Michigan is now among the number of states that require midwives to have a license to practice. Stacia Profrock is a certified professional midwife and the president of the board of directors of the Michigan Midwives Association. It is good to have you with us today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I know you've been pushing, Stacia, for this legislation. So what does it really change for midwifery in our state?
Well, one of the things that's important to understand is that certified nurse midwives have been legal to practice and licensed in Michigan for quite some time now. And so this legislation deals with the practice of certified professional midwives, who are a different group that typically practice in out-of-hospital settings, so home births, birth centers, and other care that occurs outside of the hospital.
So no more hanging out your shingle and just saying, I can do this.
Yes, and even though as midwives, we know that there has been a long history of safe practice in mm-hmm. Michigan by out-of-hospital midwives, the consumers in Michigan were frequently asking for some way of verifying the training and experience of the midwives that they were hiring. And so this sets up a standardized process for doing that.
And this is about protecting consumers and also about protecting the professional image of midwives.
It is, and it's about more than just the image. In many other states where midwives are not licensed, there have been prosecutions of midwives that are not necessarily always aligned to the severity of what that particular midwife had done. And so, of course, you know, we'd expect to see very high-profile cases around deaths or mm-hmm. injuries, but sometimes there have been prosecutions just for a midwife existing and providing basic mm-hmm. services. And so
So this formalizes everything for midwives in Michigan.
Yes, it allows for our profession to become more stable so that we can grow. Because in states where there have been new midwifery licenses, in almost every instance, the number of CPMs has increased.
And how does Michigan's law compare to other states? Because I know 35 states have midwife licensing laws. How do we compare?
I feel like our state's law is one of the best. And there's several reasons for that. We've learned over the years in licensing midwives how not to set up situations where the midwife's practice is unnecessarily restricted, but also to provide flexibility for the day-to-day details of the rules that we practice under to be changed as new medical evidence comes out, as it becomes clear that certain things aren't working. And so our law provides for documenting what the necessary training is. We get aligned with ethics and continuing education along with the other healthcare professions in Michigan. And it provides for the process of licensure and sets up some very, very basic rules for things that we can and cannot do. And then the administrative rules fill in the details for the rest. That allows the rules to change as new evidence comes mm-hmm. out. It also allows the rules to be set up by a panel of experts. Our midwifery board in Michigan is 7 certified professional midwives, 1 nurse midwife, 2 physicians, and 2 consumers. Those are the experts in our field, and they are much better equipped to make those kinds of small changes than the legislature is.
Stacia, I'm interested, is there greater or less demand for midwives in modern birthing practices?
There's a greater demand for midwives, and I believe that the growth of midwives in both the in-hospital and out-of-hospital setting would be much faster if there weren't competing conflicts of interest. In the home birth setting, births in out-of-hospital settings, including home birth and birth centers, have grown by 40% over the 6 years between 2004 and 2010. So that's an amazingly rapid rate of growth. And we see growth in the use of certified nurse midwives in all settings across the country as well. The demand for midwives is very great. And in areas where there are a lot of midwives, the utilization rates are very high.
Well, it makes me wonder, are midwives used in all types of community, rural, suburban, or urban, or are midwives more important or more necessary in one area over another?
We're important in all settings, but there are some places where our work is extremely vital. Right now, in rural settings, certified professional midwives may be the only healthcare providers doing midwifery or obstetric care in rural counties. There are many counties in Michigan that don't have any obstetric services, so no obstetrician clinics, no hospitals that deliver babies. And because certified professional midwives can make a viable practice with a smaller number of people, because we tend to provide much more personal care and have a smaller patient load, the practices can exist in those counties without having to have a particularly large population. And so our midwives, our certified professional midwives, are scattered throughout the state. There are places where we would love to have more, for example, like in the Upper Peninsula, but we are accessing places where the obstetricians are not. And in the urban areas, we do see extremely valuable work being done by certified nurse midwives. And certified professional midwives are also providing care for some underserved populations there. And so we really are filling some public health holes.
And I guess thinking of communities that could benefit from midwives, you mentioned you'd love to be in the Upper Peninsula more. Is that a case of getting people there to say, I'll go and I'll practice midwifery there? Or is it a case of getting the public to call on them?
I think there is a big public demand in the Upper Peninsula that's not being met. One of the things that is tough about certified professional midwife training is that we require that the midwives that we certify be trained by other midwives. And so a certified professional midwife needs to be trained by another certified professional midwife or a certified nurse midwife. And because there are so few of them in the Upper Peninsula, it's a kind of self-perpetuating problem.
Stacia Profrock, who's president of the Board of Directors of the Michigan Midwives Association. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Detroit's renowned Mosaic Youth Theater is marking this 60th anniversary year of Motown by going back to the earliest days of Motown. They're bringing back Now That I Can Dance, Motown 1962. This play tells the story of the Marvelettes and Motown's first number one record on the pop charts, Please, Mr. Postman. It is written and directed by my guest, Rick Sperling, who is Mosaic's founding artistic director. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
I know this is not the debut. You've done this show. Where does Now That I Can Dance rank, in your view, in the 27-year history of the Mosaic Youth Theater as far as being popular and well-received?
The most popular show we've ever done. This will be our fourth production of it. It's been 7 years, though, since we did it last, and I don't think a week goes by over that entire 7 years that someone hasn't said, when are you bringing back Now That I Can Dance? It just really hit a chord with a lot of people.
Why do you think that is?
First of all, people love Motown, not just here, but nationally, internationally. But this tells a Motown story that has never really been told before, not in Motown the Musical, not in Ain't Too Proud on Broadway right now. And that's these early gritty days. And I explain that the best way to describe these days is it's before the Supremes or the Temptations had one number one hit. So this is about when Berry Gordy and a small group of people were trying to figure out what they were doing, but the music from that era is so incredible. We focus on the Marvelettes.
Yeah, and they were four kids from Inkster, weren't they?
Actually, all together six, and then they went down to four, no one knows their story. People know Please Mr. Postman, but they don't know anything about the group, and the more I researched it, the more rich a story it was, and really a story that really represented those early days.
How so?
Well, these were girls that really had, you know, they had experience singing in their high school choir at Inkster, but they had no other experience. One of the most incredible stories that comes out of this is the story of Georgia Dobbins. And Georgia Dobbins was a 19-year-old girl from Inkster who was the lead singer for the group before they were called the Marvelettes. And Berry Gordy said, I want you to create some new material and come back after their first audition. So this girl, 19 years old, Georgia Dobbins, in 2 days writes Please Mr. Postman. They're all excited. They go back. They sing it. The Motown loves it. They said, okay, now sign your contracts. And she happened to come from a very, very religious family that didn't believe in singing anywhere outside of church. And the father would not sign the contract. And she never got to perform with the Marvelettes. And it's a really sad story. When I finally got to interview her, she said she didn't sing again after that moment. She was so hurt. She didn't sing again for 17 years. And I said, why 17 years? That's my father died in 17 years. So, I mean, those kind of stories are so, there's a tragedy and an exuberance, too. It's not just the Marvelettes, the stories of the Vandellas and how Martha Reeves kind of worked them in through the side door into their big opportunity, first as background singers for Marvin Gaye. The story of Marvin Gaye is amazing, too. In these days, Marvin Gaye was a drummer for the Miracles, and his dream was to be the Black Frank Sinatra. And all he wanted to do was sing standards. He didn't want to sing pop songs, didn't want to sing soul.
He wanted the Great American Songbook.
He wanted that. In fact, in our show, we recreate his version of Mr. Sandman.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make her the sweetest girl that I've ever seen.
And so we actually see his transformation from this guy into the Marvin Gaye that we know. And so many other kind of hidden, untold stories about what it was like for Diana Ross. She was known as Diane back then.
Yeah.
When they were the no-hit Supremes, when she was sure she was going to be a star, but everyone else was getting hits and she wasn't. This was all within... we call it Motown 1962, but it really was from 1961 to 64. All of these things happened during that time.
Long before there was Holland, Dozier, Holland, and the Supremes were playing before the Queen of England.
Exactly.
There was a lot that, and I know you relied on source material from these performers and from these artists. What struck you most as you talked to these often overlooked early Motown stars?
Well, first of all, I should say this is a collaboration with the Motown Museum. Mm-hmm. And I have to give credit to Robin Terry, the executive director, because 14 years ago, she said, why don't you do a play about Motown? And I said, well, because we want to do stories about young people. That's what Mosaic Youth Theater is about. Yeah. And Robin said, you know, in 1962, they were all teenagers. And that's when it all came together, that this was a story we could tell. But then they helped us talk to the real people. And our main source is Katherine Anderson Schaffner, who goes by Kat. She was the main Marvelette from the beginning to the end. But we also had great talks with the Vandellas, with members of the Contours, members of the Miracles, Stevie Wonder's tutor on the road, Cal Street from the Velvelettes. And one of the things that I think is so interesting is you think of this as being Detroit, and it was based in Detroit, but these kids were coming from everywhere. The Velvelettes were coming from Kalamazoo.
Didn't Stevie come from Bay City?
Right. And Saginaw area, the first number one pop hit was the Marvelettes from Inkster. So these were kids kind of coming from everywhere to Detroit to have this incredible moment.
Now, there's a lot weighing on the shoulders of this cast to get it right. These are beloved songs. So tell us a little about your cast. Where'd you draw
them
from?
We did this once before with the show where it's a multi-age group. The cast ranges in age from 11 to 50. And it was open to the community. 20 members of the cast are Mosaic alumni. Some of the key members are current members, but other people are people that we just found. The Motown Museum let us do auditions at Studio A in Hitsville. Because we were able to choose, this is the best cast we've ever had. And I've told them, because there are people in this cast that are just born to play this role. We have a 16-year-old who is born to play Gladys Horton, the lead singer of the Marvelettes. She's just born for it. But we also have someone who's born to play Marvin Gaye, someone else who's born to play Smokey Robinson. It's really a unique thing where the casting really represents who these people are. And when you have those Detroit voices there, it just has this authenticity, and especially these early days. You will hear some songs like Do You Love Me Now That I Can Dance, but there's also incredible songs like Come and Get These Memories and Stubborn Kind of Fella. And so I think that's what makes this show so popular, is that this is a story people haven't heard, but it also is something that's so, it's so relatable.
And Rex Burling, I know, I mean, you wrote this, you directed this, you have been, you're the founding artistic director, but you're not just commemorating Motown's 60th anniversary. This is your last production with Mosaic.
This is my swan song. After 27 years, I am passing the baton off to one of our alumni who was in Mosaic, then became a teaching artist and worked her way up the ranks to associate artistic director. And now Dela Shea Strotter is her name, and she's taking over. And that was really the dream when I started Mosaic, is I wanted an organization that would be sustainable long beyond me. I'll continue to be pursuing this mission, but not with Mosaic. I'm consulting with the Detroit Public Schools Community District, focusing on their Schools of the Arts and Arts Excellence Program. So it's still going to be for me about empowering young people to do great things through the arts, but on a larger scale.
When I stop and it is absolutely not hard to draw a line between the Detroit area kids who grew up to be Motown legends and the Detroit area kids who discovered the joys of performing arts through Mosaic Youth Theater. I mean, it's all a very beautifully complete circle.
We first did it, Bobby Rogers from The Miracle, who passed away a few years ago. He came to one of our rehearsals when we were talking to the kids, and he looked around and he said, "This is the first time I've felt this energy since the early days of Motown. This is what it felt like." I can't think of a better show to be my last show than this. It represents Detroit. It represents what's great about Mosaic. And to have 20 of our alumni, and I'm proud to say we're about to have our fifth alumni on Broadway this fall. One of our alumni just won a Tony Award this past year, Celia Keenan Bolger.
I saw her.
So amazing.
To Kill a Mockingbird, she plays the most beautiful scout you could ever want to see.
So great.
One of your alums.
Yes.
Well, congratulations on your 27 years with Mosaic, and a great way to celebrate your 27 years and also the 60th birthday of Motown is to go see your play.
Absolutely.
Now That I Can Dance, Motown 1962. It opens Friday, August 9th and closes August the 18th. Just go to mosaicdetroit.org. You get all the details and ticket information. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up tomorrow on Stateside, they're called the Stonewall Generation, baby boomers who are LGBT. Some 4.7 million of these LGBT elders will need some kind of care by 2030. Are there enough elder care facilities ready to accommodate their needs?
A lot of our long-term care agencies are religiously affiliated, and that can be really terrifying for someone who's LGBT.
That is tomorrow on Stateside.